I guess, and the log dependence. So basically, I guess what I'd ask you to show is that the definition of the slow roll parameter, where you write it in terms of h only, and basically it's, you know, it's going to tell you something about the deviation of h from exactly constant, so it has a first derivative of h in it. But you want epsilon to be, and the sign is basically, remember last time we said that in general we expect h dot is less than 0, right? And we're gonna come back to this point in a minute, but we said for most cases h dot was less than 0, so we put a sign here so epsilon is positive. But we want a dimensionless parameter here, right? Dimensionless number is better to work with. H is dimension of 1 over length, dimension of energy, and the derivative then gives us another dimension of energy. So we have to choose something to normalize it with. And so the only scale in the problem is h, so basically, you know, what you very naively do is you divide by h squared. So this is sort of a very naive way of saying why that's a reasonable parameter. And we also saw that with this definition, then, epsilon less than 1 corresponded to accelerated expansion. But this also is a nice definition because there are basically several ways to organize how you think about what's going on during inflation, right? So the schematic picture that we have in our head is that there's a potential V of phi, something like this, and you imagine a little scalar field sort of classically rolling along that potential. So basically, the important thing is that, in terms of observation, right, the important thing for the fluctuations is that as you go along, modes are expanding and they're freezing out of the horizon. And because h isn't exactly constant, there's some slight scale dependence or time dependence to how those things are happening. So we can think of that as a time dependence if we think of cosmological time. We can think of that as a phi dependence if we use the position of the classical field as a clock, which people often do. They just forget about cosmological time. Or we can think about that in terms of the modes that are actually freezing out outside of the horizon, right? Which would be thinking about it in terms of k equal to ah, where now, you know, h is nearly a constant, and a is the thing that's sort of changing with time or with position phi. So what's convenient about this definition is that when you want to ask physically what's the consequences for observables, we had this definition where we had this dimensionless power spectrum, which I think I called delta squared, and you know, heuristically or phenomenologically, we wrote that as some constant k over some pivot point to this spectral index, ns minus 1. But what we're going to find out is that, of course, you know, when we make a prediction from inflation, this deviation from scale invariance is dependent on the parameters that we have in the system that we set up, right, the scalar field model, which is essentially h, epsilon, eta. So what we find is that this thing is actually equal to h squared, let me forget about the 8 pi, over m Planck squared, so certainly it depends on the energy scale of inflation. But it also depends, it's going to turn out, on this parameter epsilon in the denominator. So when you want to evaluate what's the prediction for ns minus 1 here, basically what you need to do are take, you know, derivatives of this expression. So we defined ns minus 1, and you checked this as d log delta squared d log k. So since these are the guys that appear, if you know d log h, d log k, and d log epsilon, d log k, this is really easy to work out. And it turns out that this definition of epsilon and the corresponding definition, so if we want to get, basically we need variation of h and variation of epsilon. So here's variation of h. So the natural kind of way to define variation of epsilon is to say, well, let's define a new parameter. It's going to be variation of epsilon, so let's call it epsilon dot. Epsilon is already dimensionless. There's one dimension from the time derivative, so to normalize it, we should put an h. And we want it to be a logarithmic derivative, so let's also just divide by epsilon again, so that what we get is the d by d log. Okay? So that's a very natural way to define these parameters, and it's extremely convenient because it's very easy to read off what the answer is here. Okay. Does that sort of clarify what the questions were in the tutorial? Okay. Super. Okay. So the other thing that you asked me to explain in a little more detail is what's the point of this condition that we talked about, h dot less than or equal to 0. So basically, yeah, let's go back to that. So last time, so this is a little bit of a digression, but actually it's a really interesting point. And so let me say a few more words. Digression on h dot less than or equal to 0. OK, so what we said last time we were looking at sort of, you know, again, why these are good definitions of the slow roll parameters. And we said that when we have the condition rho plus p, so we're talking about the scalar field, this is the energy density, this is the pressure, when this thing is greater than or equal to zero, that implies that the only thing h dot can do, or h can do, is decrease. Okay. Why do we care about that? So basically, I explained a little bit that the reason we care is that most sources of matter that we can think of, classical fields that we can think of, are going to satisfy this condition and are going to satisfy this condition. And so it's sort of a good, it's a good thing to keep in mind about the behavior of most solutions that go by the name of inflation. Now, this type of thing that we did here is we said, here's the solution that we want, right? We want some scale factor that behaves in a certain way, and here's a condition on the matter that we put in that sources that behavior. It's something that people do a lot in GR, right? And so that's why I told you that this was a consequence of the null energy condition. Now, in terms of inflation, you don't have to know any more than what we just said, that most sources of classical matter behave in this way, and so they give you this behavior. But the reason that I mentioned the null energy condition is just because that's a more, it's a general prescription that people try to do in other contexts, right? Not just inflation, but in general in GR, you often have, so more generally, so aside from inflation, let's just say more generally, we have this situation where basically we can find or we can write geometries. Thanks. That are, let's say, weird, right? So for example, they might be aclausal. They might have closed time-like curves, so it looks like you can go around and around and, you know, go back and kill your grandfather or whatever. People are always curious about how do you make wormholes, right? You go to any public lecture and people say, what's the status of wormholes? So in general, you can write down these solutions, these geometries, and it looks like you can do really cool things. But the question is, you know, Can we get those? Can we make those? Can we source those with, let me say, realistic in quotes, matter? Right? Just because you can write down one side of Einstein equation and you can imagine what sort of team you knew that might give rise to doesn't mean that necessarily when you write Lagrangians for all the fields that you're familiar with and you calculate team you knew, that team you knew can give you the properties that you want here. And it turns out that there are lots and lots and lots of versions of energy conditions that do various things for you. The reason it's a little bit, it's easy to make a precise statement one way, that if matter does X, you don't get a causality. But it's very difficult to say, you know, if matter doesn't behave X, is it necessarily a causal, or can it necessarily give me weird solutions? So this isn't a completely finished story. But let me just give you a little bit of a reference point for what's going on with the scalar field. That's kind of useful. So in cosmology, and especially in inflation, you know, we've been talking about scalar fields, but scalar fields are really sort of a subset of a more general class of things that we think are relevant for cosmology, which are perfect fluids. So let's just look at perfect fluids. And we're going to need this anyway later today. So let me write down what I mean by a perfect fluid. So basically, a perfect fluid is a shorthand for a particular form of the stress energy tensor that we're going to use when we get general perturbation expressions. And essentially, the idea is that we want it to be, we don't want any special direction, and we don't want momentum transfer in weird directions. So you can work out more rigorously why this is a good ansatz. But essentially, what we say is that the form of the stress energy tensor should look like this. I'll explain to you what U is in just a second. This is energy density, this is pressure, and then there's a term that's pressure times g mu. And what this U is the fluid velocity. And all this stuff is defined in the rest frame of the fluid. So this u, since it's the velocity, if I write it as a normal vector, is just the derivative of the coordinates with respect to the proper time. Okay. And there's a very nice normalization of this, obviously, then, which is just to say that this is going to be equal to 1, 0, 0, 0. So you can normalize it, normalize the velocity, such that the norm is essentially minus 1. Okay? So you're just moving along with the fluid. So we're going to use this later for the fluctuations, but we can also use it to easily evaluate what this condition is. Okay? Why I said that this was an all energy condition. Okay. So just so that you see it once, the null energy condition is a restriction on T mu nu, and it's a restriction that says, that asks that T mu nu contracted with a null vector, a light-like vector, L mu L nu, any version, is greater than or equal to 0. Okay? This is any null vector. Okay, so then basically, if this is a null vector, you can see that if I plug our prescription for T mu nu in here, the term that's G mu nu is not going to give us anything, right, because this is null. And because of the way we've normalized the velocity u over there, and it just has a 1 in the first entry there, you can see that we get exactly, for the perfect fluid, we get exactly this condition for the null energy condition. Okay? Okay, so let me say a couple more things. This is relatively, as energy conditions go, this is a relatively, permissive condition. And for perfect fluids, you can make a little diagram of the various energy conditions, which is kind of nice. Let's put rho here. Let's put P here. So the prescription we just had basically tells us that we can allow anything in this region when we have the null energy condition. And there are various stronger conditions that you hear about sometimes that basically chop out versions of parts of this region. Okay? So let me get a color. And I just want to show you this because I want to show you that this is an easy condition to remember, but it's a bit of a long trek from this kind of general statement about geometry to this condition. So let me just sort of illustrate what that trek is. So if I look at this region here, this region is a more restrictive region that's allowed by something called a dominant energy condition, which sometimes people extend to also include this line. So this is GEC, and if you include this line, right, which is a negative cosmological constant, which is certainly a physically reasonable solution, then it's a null version of the DEC. And all of these things can be phrased in terms of, again, contracting vectors with T mu nu. Yeah?
So, the null line is the dominant energy condition. Null dominant energy condition?
So this region is dominant, right. And if you include this line with that region, then
the negative cosmological constant would be on the line.
On this line, yeah.
So did the Gödel universe that's negative?
No, it's positive. So what I'm explaining now is in some ways not relevant for inflation. What I just want to explain is a little bit, so I gave you the reason of the condition that's relevant for inflation, but there's a lot of, fancy dressing of why people have proposed these various energy conditions, and so I want to explain a little bit about why you might propose various.
But this is in four dimensions, right?
That's right. Yeah, thanks. So the reason I'm drawing this one is because that's actually the one that people use to say, if you satisfy this energy condition, then you have no acausal behavior. Okay, it's more restrictive, So this is the one that implies no weird stuff. Okay. If you include this region, then this is the weak energy condition. And you can write all of these things in terms of prescriptions on rho and p, which is why I'm drawing it in this plane. But basically, you can instead of contracting a null vector, you can contract a time-like vector here. You can do various things. But what I wanted to show you is just that it's actually more restrictive, the one that's sort of more detailed, more in detail connected to causality. Null energy condition is a little bit less restrictive. But the basic point of all of these conditions is that normal matter, so if you look at scalar fields, you look at electromagnetism, you look at most of the things that you would normally write down in particle physics, they satisfy actually this one. And then cosmological constant gives you this, and you can play around a little bit to try to get stuff that falls in this region. But most normal matter satisfies all of this, okay? And that's actually really interesting for this course, because in some sense, yes, let me write this down. So why do we care? So why do we care? Why do we care for cosmology? Well, the most important point about all of this is that classical matter most of it satisfies very restrictive properties, but it certainly satisfies this one. Okay, that's great. But actually, we're talking about quantum fields here, right? We're talking about the quantum scalar field. And that's, in some sense, where all of the really interesting stuff comes in with gravity, right? You've already had your quantum gravity course, probably. And the point is that quantum fields, quantum matter fields, in general, violate these conditions. So you could spend time, let me put this in parentheses, you could, and people do, spend time figuring out what conditions you need with quantum fields to avoid sort of weirdness. But they end up looking a little more complicated, and it's not, you know, I don't think there's a simple answer, but basically they end up looking like integrations of the fields over some, you know, time-like geodesic or something like that. But the other thing that happens is just that results that you proved in classical GR are violated. And probably the most interesting one is one that you're already familiar with. For example, if you look at classical sources, right, there's a theorem about black holes, and the theorem about black holes is that the area always increases. Black holes accrete, right, in classical GR. So you get an area theorem that basically tells you that A dot is always greater than or equal to zero. Black holes are growing. But you know that quantum mechanically, quantum effect is that the black hole evaporates and the area goes the other way. And basically that's because the quantum fields don't have to satisfy the same conditions that you use to prove this condition. There's an interesting example also in inflation, which is a little bit more relevant for what we're doing here. And I don't think, did Andrew talk about stochastic inflation? I don't think he got to it. Okay. So the example for inflation is stochastic eternal inflation. And this is a regime where the quantum fluctuations dominate over the classical behavior. Right? So we said as long as the, oops, I keep erasing my potential, as long as the classical rolling of the field is what's sourcing inflation, the field rolls down the hill, H dot decreases. But in this regime, the quantum fluctuations. Dominate. And by that, basically, we just mean that, same picture again, classical motion is doing this. But if the quantum fluctuations are sort of as likely as the classical motion, right, and that's sort of set by the amplitude of the fluctuation, h, compared to the rate of classical rolling, which is phi dot for the background, if those jumps are the, sort of the dominant behavior, then just due to fluctuations, we can basically always sit somewhere up here on the potential and inflate. Right? You don't have to exit sort of globally because the field doesn't have to roll down the hill. The fluctuations can dominate. Now, that's a statistical statement about a set of regions. Any one region actually does exit if you just look at a Hubble patch. But if you look at the global space where you have many, many Hubble patches, this is a regime where the space seems to keep, you know, self-reproducing. And that's a very interesting puzzle, an interesting part of inflation, because if inflation already always has this regime where it's eternal, you always get these infinite spaces that are always inflating, and there are a lot of sort of associated puzzles. But again, you get that behavior when the quantum fluctuations dominate, and then at least, so let's say, at least locally, and at least on short times, because that's where we can be sure for any one patch that we can actually do the calculation. So by locally, I mean in a Hubble patch. And I also mean on scales not smaller than Hubble patch. So I also mean on Hubble scales. On Hubble scales, you can find that h dot seems to go the other way, right? You seem to jump up the potential. So in a lot of ways, this is really where the real, you know, inflation, as we're discussing it so far, in some ways, it is sort of quantum fields in de Sitter space, but the end result is that things sort of classicalize, and we have classical curvature fluctuations that are small. And so in some sense, the normal, you know, inflationary story and inflationary fluctuations, even though it is quantum, it isn't very deeply quantum, at least at the first order level that we usually calculate to match the CMB. But the whole story, on the other hand, is sort of deeply quantum, and there are really interesting sort of issues and puzzles associated with that. Okay? Okay, so anyway, this is interesting stuff, so that's why I wanted to clarify a little bit why that condition comes in. Yeah?
So we have said this already, but where does that negative cosmological constant?
Yeah, so I guess the negative cosmological constant, okay, there's a lot of things a person could say here, is a very interesting scenario, right? So negative cosmological constant is in some sense a more stable space, an anti-de Sitter space, a space that people spend a lot of time working on, and basically is this line. So it does fit into to some extent, but I guess the only way it fits into this cosmological story over here is that in some ways it's a much easier space to address all of these questions in. So people have learned a lot about ADS space. De Sitter is much, much more difficult. And so I don't know if you learned, you may have learned in string theory or something, it's hard to find stable de Sitter solutions. People have a really hard time doing anything about quantum mechanics in de Sitter space. So it's a much more interesting, much, much harder question in a lot of ways, as opposed to ADS. Of course, that's reality, right? That's the world we live in now. So at some point, it'd be a good idea if we understood it. Okay. Right. So this is a long digression. But this is kind of some of the stuff that's on the forefront, and the calculation that we're doing in some sense is a, you know, it's an old calculation. Once you do it, you do it. But this is sort of more interesting. So I think it's worth the time. All right, so now let's forget about all that and let's go back to the calculation we were doing last time. Okay, so remember the point that we were at was that we decided that we wanted to perturb this scalar field. The scalar field fluctuations were going to give us this power spectrum. And I already told you the answer. It's going to go like h squared over m pi squared root epsilon, right? But basically, we have to work out why that's a good answer. And the reason it's hard to get to that answer is because when we perturb the scalar field part, right, the stress energy tensor, the source, we have to also make sure that we perturb the metric, because somehow this is going to become our curvature perturbations at the end of inflation. So we were starting to perturb the metric, and we saw that this is kind of a mess, right? Because first of all, there are lots and lots of terms in the metric. There are lots of degrees of freedom there. And we'd figured out that we had some scalars, some vectors, and some tensors. And when we had sort of rearranged our first naive way of writing down what all the fluctuations were, we found that we had four scalars, and we called them little phi, which is going to vanish hopefully in this lecture if we have time, little psi, b, and e. We had two vectors, and these were all vectors with the condition, so I think we called them, what do we call them, f? I don't even remember. F and maybe S, I'm not sure if I labeled them. And they all had the condition that di, fi, or si was equal to 0, so because we removed a scalar part. And then we had a tensor. Sorry, there were two of these, and they each have 2 degrees of freedom, right? Because they would have 3, but then there's this condition. And then we had just one tensor from which we'd removed a bunch of different components, and I think we called that little hij. And because we'd taken out basically the trace of that guy and we'd made it transverse, this only had 2 degrees of freedom left. But anyway, we ended up with 10 total. This was traceless and transverse. Yeah, sorry. So basically, we have the condition. Kind of the analog of this condition here, right? Let me make sure I get all the indices in the right place. So basically, I want to take a derivative of this guy. There's only one of them, so I have to contract one of the indices to do that. So I think that's the right way to write it. Okay, thanks. Yeah, okay. All right, so mostly, I'm just going to focus, we need to focus on the scalar part. Okay, this is going to be the gravitational wave part. This is going to be a part that doesn't really matter. But this is the part that's sort of tricky because you can see we have a lot of terms here and we have our delta phi. So this is in some ways the hardest one, and that's the one where that will work out. Okay, so we're going to focus on the scalars. But what we haven't done yet is we haven't used the fact that we're free to change coordinates, right? So we always have this freedom that we can reset our coordinates. And we talked about that a little bit last time because we talked about how physically you might want to look, you might want to follow different time slices as you go through inflation. You might want to ask, what's happening to surfaces of constant density, maybe? Because, in fact, where inflation ends is a constant density surface. So if you want to match on to what happens after inflation, that might be a good thing to follow. You're also, in some sense, following curvature perturbations. So maybe you want to look in a frame where curvature perturbations are zero or where they're the only thing and you have all the perturbations in the density, something like that. You have various choices you might want to make. Sorry, that was a little convoluted, but we're going to do an example on the homework so then it'll be more clear what I'm trying to say. But anyway, the point is you can make these coordinate transformations and that in some sense introduces a redundancy or a difference in description, right? You thought you had no perturbation density but change coordinates and actually you do. So we need to worry about that. So we need to figure out what to do with the freedom to change coordinates. Okay. So remember that the framework that we're working in is that we've assumed that what we can do is take our full metric and write it as a background space which we're imposing is FRW. Plus the perturbations, okay? And let me write here the form of the perturbed metric, and then we'll leave it sit there. So again, this way of writing it is subject to a lot of conventions about signs and all that, so I'm going to write one choice. Which is to put the phi variable here with a factor of 2 and a plus sign, d eta squared. So then last time I wrote this in terms of the general vectors and general tensors, now I'm going to write just the scalar part. Okay, because it's a little bit simpler. And so the scalar part that sits here, let's call b, right? And I have to have a derivative of that scalar to make sure that when I write this as an off-diagonal term in terms of the dxi, those contract, the eta. And then I have a little bit longer term that's for the dxi, dxj part, because we took out already, with the minus sign, the scalar psi, who lives on the diagonal. But then we also have the off-diagonal terms, right? And that's what we were calling the e. And if that's a scalar, this needs to have two derivatives. Yep. And that's the dxi, dxj. Okay. So let me also write over here the convention that we're going to use for making our coordinate transformation. So here I'm going to say that the coordinate x mu is going to become a tilde coordinate, which is related to the old x mu by an infinitesimal variation. So really, it's important here that we're only going to do first-order stuff here, okay? Infinitesimal variation, c, and this guy can depend on both space and time. And just for consistency with what we did up here, here we had sort of a difference in the way we were treating the spatial part, the time part, and the spatial parts. So similarly, right, just like when we had a generic vector here, we extracted a piece that was really a scalar, and the piece that was left over, right, which was our 2-degree of freedom vector that was left over, we're going to do the same thing for xi, and we're going to write the xi as a piece that's one of these transverse guys. So this guy as di xi equals 0. And then we're going to pull out of that a scalar piece, which is going to be di zeta. Okay? This zeta is the scalar. All right. So those are my conventions. And now what we need to do is actually see what happens to the perturbations when we make this transformation. Yeah?
Do you mean by I, just a spatial
component? Yeah, exactly. So we want to mimic for this coordinate transformation what we did up here for the pieces of the metro.
You still have one component.
I still have one component.
C0?
That's right, I have C0, and then I have these guys, exactly. So So my answer for what's going to happen to the scalars can be written in terms of C0 and this zeta, and this piece, this transverse piece, would only be relevant if I looked at the transformation for the vectors. Sorry, that's a bit too low, isn't it? Can everybody read that? Okay.
Sorry, can I just
clarify
one thing? In general, a general coordinate transformation will mix up the scalars and the vectors and the tensors.
If I look at first order only, then I can sort of divide things up into what happens to the tensors, the vectors, and the scalars separately. Yeah, so maybe make it up. Yeah, that's okay. Let me say it again. So there's actually, sometimes people call this the scalar vector tensor, or SVT, decomposition. You can call it a theorem. Which is basically just that if I work at first order, and you can check this in various ways, the easiest way, or maybe the most brute force way to check it is just to go through this procedure, which we'll do for the scalars, the vectors, the tensors, and see that in fact they don't mix up. But the idea is that in fact I don't have to worry about how these combine at first order. So there are lots of complications that could creep in. Because really, this is a bit artificial, right, to divide up into a background and a fluctuation and sort of to impose the background. There are lots of complications that could creep in if we weren't sure, in the context of inflation, that it was sort of, in some sense, you know, okay in a physical way to talk about the classical background and the fluctuations, which are small on top of that. But that's, in some ways, that makes our life simpler, and we're allowed to just focus on what happens to the first-order fluctuations to get the answer that we want for the power spectrum. All right, so basically our goal today is to find out what happens to phi psi BE under x mu goes to x mu tilde. Okay, to first order. All right, well, we know that, let's start with the most general thing we can write down, right? We know that in general, if I want to write down g mu nu tilde in the tilde coordinates, right, I want to ask how does g mu nu transform, we know what that looks like, right? So it's going to be related to the original g, let's call it alpha beta, which was a function of the coordinates x. And how is it related? Well, I just need to do the coordinate transformations that match up the indices, right? So if I put here dx, let's see, alpha, right, dx tilde mu, dx beta, dx tilde nu. Okay, is that right? My mu's and nu's match. My alphas and betas match. Okay. And we can write what this is because we made a definition for how we were going to change coordinates. So what is this? So basically, I want to take, it's a little bit, I really want to rearrange this so that it's x in terms of x tilde minus c, right? But if I take a derivative of that, the first term is going to be a derivative of x with respect to itself, basically. So there's just a delta function for the indices, delta alpha mu, minus, because I moved c to the other side. And it's just going to be dxc, again, alpha is the index I have upstairs, with respect to dx mu, right? It's easy to make algebra mistakes on the board, so everybody check me. OK. And then, of course, I have the same thing here, except that now it's beta nu instead of alpha and mu. So I have delta beta nu minus dxc beta dx tilde nu. And here I've got g alpha beta. Now, OK, well, let me save that later. But for the terms that are already first ordering c, I can start to be sloppy about whether I'm using x's or x tildes, right? Because the difference between x's and x tildes is going to be, again, proportional to c. So only keeping terms to first order, these differences and the difference of what this is, which coordinate sits inside here, is not going to matter, OK? All right. So let's write out what this is, actually, though. So if I have, so again, I only want to keep to first order. So there's a second order term here that I'm going to drop. So let's go approximately. So certainly I have this piece here, which is just g now mu nu of x. And then I have each of the first order terms, which each come with a minus sign. And in each case, one of the indices on the g is going to be replaced with a mu or a nu. And I'm going to have one of these derivatives. So I'm going to have a g. Let's take this one. That's going to be a g mu beta dxc beta dx nu. And then the symmetric term, which is going to be g alpha nu dxc alpha dx. Oops, I already messed up. That's a mu. That's a nu. No, sorry. That's nu. That's a mu. All right, so I've got mu nu left over. Yeah, and the alphas or the betas can join. OK. But what we really wanted to ask were, how do the perturbations transform, right? And here I've written the total thing. So I need to divide each of these pieces into a background and a perturbation. So on this side, we're going to write this as g mu nu bar of x tilde plus delta g mu nu tilde. And here we're going to take this guy to be g mu nu bar of x plus delta g mu nu.
Better to write that as g tilde bar?
As g tilde bar. Yeah, so sure. Yeah.
I just want to make
yeah, that's fine. So basically, I'm gonna cheat in a minute and set those bars equally. You know it's coming. So yeah. But yeah, to be completely formal, that's right. At this point, let's assume we're not saying anything about what the background is at each point. Okay. Some background, some fluctuations. Now the point of doing this, of course, is that I want to somehow say that I'm allowed to fix the background and say it's the same in both coordinates, and then just look at the fluctuations. Which again, you know, as long as I'm doing things, you know, small infinitesimal fluctuations, I'm going to be able to do that. But I have to fix one other thing first, which is that I know, so these are both background quantities, these are the fluctuations, but there's actually another sort of perturbation term hidden in here, which is the difference between the x tilde and the x coordinate on the background. So I also have to now change coordinates inside here, and that's going to give me one other term. Okay. So we also need, before I'm allowed to do my trick, we also need to say that g mu of x bar, so the background piece, is approximately equal to, so let me write it out first, because what I'm basically doing here is just replacing x by the change of coordinate, right? So that's x tilde minus c. Okay? So if I do a Taylor expansion now, I'm allowed to say this is g mu nu of x tilde minus, this is going to be a contraction between a variation of the background metric with respect to some index times the perturbation in that index, g mu nu. And now this is, again, doesn't matter x or x tilde here, right? To first order, they're the same. So I guess I'm using x. And we want to claim we're perturbing around the same if our W background. So let's say that this G mu nu bar, or there was a twiddle secretly, of x tilde is equal to this G mu nu bar of x tilde. Okay, so then what's left over is what we wanted. It's basically this term was what it was. We're canceling it with the first order piece of this term. So basically this guy and part of this guy. So on one side we're left with the new perturbation and the new coordinates, right? That's what we were looking for. So now we've got delta g mu nu twiddle. And we have that in terms of the fluctuation in the original coordinate, delta g mu nu. And then there are three correction terms, right? There's this correction term in the background. So that's minus c lambda d lambda g mu nu bar. And now because I've taken out the background fluctuation, right, all of the g's that are sitting next to first order perturbations become g bar to first order. Okay, so these are all backgrounds now that appear here. Yes.
Why did you tilde in that second term of the Taylor expansion?
In this term?
Yes.
Because it's first order in C already. So any other variations? Okay. And then I have these two correction terms. So these are both going to be now the background metric G mu beta bar D C beta x nu and g bar alpha nu dxc alpha dx nu. Okay, hopefully that's the right expression because we're going to need to use that. So let's just take a minute and look. Mu nu, everybody has mu nu. Other indices are contracted. There's three terms. Okay, I think that's right. So now what we can do is we can take, for example, one of the components of the metric that we had, here's the delta G00 term, and ask how that guy transforms. Okay? So can I do that here? Does everybody have this part? Okay, so let's work out. Delta G, 0, 0, 12. All right, so what do we have? Delta G, 0, 0, in the new coordinate. Well, okay, let's so over here we have delta G, 0, 0, the old thing, is minus 2 phi a squared, right? And that's the first term right there. So this is minus 2 a squared, this little phi. Minus, okay, well, in general, this now we have this contraction. It could be any of the components of C, right? So we could have C lambda, P lambda. Now the background G00, what's the background G00? That's our FRW, right? That's just this one, minus A squared. And remember, A squared is only a function of eta, right? The background is only a function of time. That's going to simplify our life here. It's just going to be one term. And then here we also have minus the background, so this is G bar, mu is 0, beta in principle we don't know, dxc beta dx, well, 0 again, right? The second term is essentially the same thing, except now this is alpha 0, dxc alpha dx 0. So now the fact that our background is diagonal, it's symmetric, right? And then on the diagonal, there are no off-diagonal terms, simplifies everything. And the diagonal is only a function of eta. Right? So this simplifies a lot. This is just minus 2a squared phi minus, this is only now the zero component that we need. And this is just going to be a derivative with respect to conformal time. Let's pull out the minus sign a squared. And this guy now, the only term that contributes is the 0, 0 term. And the 0, 0 term is, again, minus a squared. So this becomes plus a squared. Now, this is 0, right? So we've got c0 dx0. And, in fact, these two terms are the same, right? The only difference here is the indices. But, again, only the diagonal term is contributing. So we just get a factor of 2 there. So now let's write our tilde perturbation in the same form as this, right? A didn't change after all. So let's just write it as the same thing as this, but a phi tilde. So let's define it this way, phi tilde. And then we can ask what happens to phi tilde, right? The rest of the stuff is just traveling along for convenience anyway. So 2a squareds cancel out, so it's phi. If there was no perturbation, it would be the same thing. Then it's c0. Sorry, so this is a 2a a prime, right? So if we get rid of the minus sign, there, and this becomes minus, the 2 and the 2 from the derivative will cancel. There's an a squared here and just an a prime here. So this is c0 a prime over a. This is also minus because it's plus here. The 2 goes away, a squared goes away, and it's just c0 prime, right? So now I'm just using primes as shorthand for derivative with respect to conformal time. So dot is going to be cosmological time, prime is conformal time. And I can rewrite that a little bit to say this is actually minus 1 over a c0 prime. Okay. So you can go through that same exercise for all of the terms. And you would find that the psi, the diagonal piece in the spatial part, is of course the original psi plus a prime over a c0. B is this mixed off-diagonal piece, eta and x, is B plus zeta prime minus c0. And E is just E plus zeta. Let's put phi back here so you have them all in the same spot. Sorry, yeah, thanks. So it was important that, because we're working at first order, this now is just the background metric here. And remember, we were imposing, basically, that it was the same FRW. So what we had was a matrix that was minus A squared, A squared, A squared, A squared. So it's diagonal. Sorry, that's a lot to write. Let's see. Okay, let me try to put the notes here so that I don't erase anything for those of you that are still writing. So notice. Basically, if you want, you can make a coordinate choice here, right? So basically, I have four of these guys, four scalar fields. And they all have transformations that only depend on zeta and xi0, right? So basically, transformations depend only on xi0 and zeta. So basically, that means I can choose coordinates such that two scalars vanish. Okay? So in other words, there's a redundancy here, right, thanks to my ability to change coordinates. And I can remove that redundancy by removing two of these guys. So in some sense, there's only two real degrees of freedom I have to worry about here. And when people do this, when they make a coordinate choice for what, you know, what to choose here, they usually call that a choice of gauge, okay? Again, because the coordinate, the redundancy because of my freedom to change coordinates is very reminiscent of a gauge freedom. So often, so to calculate, people choose, if you like, a gauge, which just means a coordinate choice. And there are lots of coordinate choices that you can make that sort of reduce the physics that looks familiar. So lots of people make different choices based on what kind of physics they want to be most transparent. Although, of course, in the end, you know, the answer that we get, we have to be able to interpret in any of these. So in fact, the second point is that we can make, because there are only, we can actually formally sort of remove this freedom by choosing a combination of these variables that are invariant under these transformations. So there are going to be two combinations that are invariant under the transformations. So at the level of first order perturbations only, they look sort of like gauge invariant variables. So we can choose combinations. And I'm going to have to erase something. What shall I erase? Can I erase the example? So we can choose combinations that are invariant under that transformation. And people usually call those capital phi and capital psi. And since we're a little bit short on time, let me just write down for you what they are and not try to work it out. But you can check. You can take these equations and just check by plugging this in that these are the right combinations, which are built, which start by being built by this little phi and this little psi, but they have corrections, of course, from the B and the E. So capital phi is little phi minus 1 over A times A, B minus E prime, whole thing derivative with respect to conformal time. And capital psi is little psi, it's A prime over A times B minus E prime. So what's very useful about these combinations is that you can choose for yourself a very simple coordinate choice. For example, where B and E are set to 0. That's a very common choice. So a common choice and a useful choice is called Newtonian gauge. It's called this because this guy that's left over looks very much like the Newtonian potential if you sort of expand in a weak field limit. Newtonian gauge, you set E equals B equals 0. It's a very simple choice, right? Your metric drastically simplifies because all you have now are sort of symmetric looking time and space parts. You don't have any of these off-diagonal terms, so it's very simple looking. You can do your computations in that gauge, for example, with that coordinate choice. Then you can come back up here and given any other coordinate choice, you know what the corresponding variables are going to look like because these combinations are always invariant. So it allows you to take one coordinate choice, compute something, and then see what that result would be in any other coordinate choice. Okay? So basically these are useful for easy coordinate changes. But you do have to be careful, right? Because it's easy. You can see that the thing we didn't talk about so far is that there are derivatives here, right? So you can see that it's possible to make gauge choices that still have some redundancy left over because that you still have some freedom to make choices up to constants because of these derivatives. Okay? So let's say careful. For example, there's something called synchronous gauge. That a lot of people liked because you sort of follow sort of freely falling fluid elements. So that, again, seems like a very natural physical choice to do. And when you make that choice, that corresponds to saying that phi, let me put an S for synchronous, phi and B are equal to 0. But if you look here, B and phi is the one combination where both of these depend on derivatives, right, of zeta and of c0. So you can easily redefine your time, right? You can see that if I set phi equal to 0, I can certainly redefine c0 up to a constant. And then if I want to set b equal to 0, even if I define this thing up to a constant, I can always define this thing up to a constant. Do you guys want me to go through that, or is that okay? You can write out explicitly what the freedom that's allowed still is, but so you can see this is a constant change here. You remove that constant in the definition of zeta, and you have another constant because this is a derivative. Okay? So basically, this doesn't fix everything. So this still allows some coordinate changes. If you want, next time I can write down explicitly what it is, but basically, the point that I'm trying to make here is you can make choices that seem very physically reasonable, but they still actually do allow you some coordinate freedom. Okay? This one is kind of a good choice because it's physically transparent. It fixes everything, right? E and B together, there's a derivative here, but there's no derivative on zeta here, and there's no derivative here. So that's a good choice. And it's very physically useful. Yeah?
So can I think of the Newtonian gauge as the synchronous gauge as the Lorentz gauge?
Is that the Lorentz gauge? I always forget exactly which one corresponds
to which.
Lorentz
gauge still has this freedom left over.
Yeah.
Coulomb gauge or some other gauge
doesn't. Yeah. So that's true, except that there are actually many choices I can make here that have coordinate freedom left over.
Right.
So there are many.
Analogy.
Okay. Yeah. If you want to make broad classes, then yeah, that's true. Yeah. Okay. Any other questions about that? Okay. So, let's see. There's something else quick I can say. Yeah, basically, let me just set up where we're going next time, okay? And then I won't do any details, but let me just set it up for you. Up to? Basically, we're doing this, right, because we have the Einstein equation. Okay, great. So we have the Einstein equation. Here you go. blank squared minus 2 t mu nu. And what we've done now is, you know, we made sort of a heuristic argument that we wanted to vary the scalar field, which lives here, so we should vary g mu nu. So what we did is we wrote this as a g mu nu bar, right? Really, so this contains r and it contains r mu nu, but those are all just functions of the metric. So by going through all this for the metric, now what we have effectively is a g mu nu plus a delta g mu nu. And over here, what we need to do is a t mu nu bar and a delta t mu nu. But we know, for example, that for the scalar field, things are relatively simple, right? We know that the only two components we need are the energy density. So this is.
Depends on the background field by 0 dot squared. That's the potential as a function of the background field. And the pressure is also dz. 0 dot squared minus v by 0. So what we still need. And what we're claiming basically is we can set g mu nu bar equal to t mu nu bar, and this is what we want to solve as leftover. Okay? This we've already done, because that's FRW solution. We know that that works. We want to do this part. And we want to put in what we found for the quantization of the scalar field here and see what that implies when we actually work in whatever degree of freedom is that's relevant for inflation. So we still need to write delta t mu nu and see. So I set up for this because we wrote earlier in the hour what t mu nu was for the scalar field, right? Very generically in terms of the pressure, the energy density, and the velocity of the scalar field. So we just need to go through and perturb, for example,
delta t 0 to get what the perturbation to delta rho is. And that's very, as you can see, it's going to be extremely straightforward up to the fact that there's that velocity hanging out in there. So we have to do one little trick to figure out what happens with that velocity. But otherwise, it's extremely straightforward. And then what we'll be left with are equations for delta g, which is really in terms of, for example, phi and psi. And then we just relate that to what we're going to get when we plug in for delta phi here. Okay? So that's the step we'll do next time. And then we're going to be almost done because we'll see what variable actually matters, and we can plug in our solution that you got for quantizing the scalar field.